Old and New Testament, we read first of all in Genesis 1. Then if you would keep the place open there and turn to Romans chapter 1 as well. We're going to read from Romans 1:18 after we've read a few verses from Genesis 1. And perhaps I should explain, for the benefit of those who didn't read the last copy of our church magazine, that what I'm hoping to do over the next several weeks is to examine some of the title headings, some of the chapter headings found in a little booklet, Ultimate Questions, by John Blanchard, which is being distributed throughout our membership at this time. A booklet that's designed to make us all think through important issues related to our faith. And this morning we're concerned to discover the God who is there. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning, the first day. And that set the pattern for the rest of God's creation, and we take it up again in verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant in the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. To all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. Now over in Romans chapter 1 and from verse 18. Things have changed since that first reading. Man has rebelled against God. Man has been alienated himself from God's presence and fellowship. And we read in verse 18, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over to the sinful desires of their hearts, to sexual impurity, for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. May God seal these readings of his word to our hearts, to our eternal benefit. And now, on a number of occasions when I've been taking classes in school, I've given the children the opportunity, perhaps foolishly on my part, but I've given them the opportunity to ask me questions. And I've lost count of the number of times when they've asked, "Tell us, where did God come from? Where did God come from?" And I imagine that often that question has represented a genuine spirit of inquiry. But sadly, I am also convinced that often the children are echoing what they hear their parents say in their home. Parents who perhaps argue something like this: if we don't know where God comes from, we won't believe in God. How can anyone believe in God? Where did he come from? Often from individuals who have themselves stifled any genuine spirit of inquiry. How do we respond to that kind of question? And to the attitude of heart that lies behind it. I want to suggest to you this morning that that question is flawed for a number of reasons. First of all, it is flawed because the question is inconsistently applied. For example, we don't hear of people saying, "I won't believe in the existence of the world unless I know where it comes from." And when you press the materialistic scientist to explain the existence of the world, he will invariably say the ultimate source of the world is a Big Bang that took place millions of years ago. Let me quote: "The universe was created in a gigantic explosion, and that the various elements observed today were produced within the first few minutes after the bang, when the extremely high temperature and density of the universe would fuse subatomic particles into the chemical elements. The extremely high density within the primeval atom would cause the universe to expand rapidly. As it expanded, the hydrogen and helium would cool and condense into stars and galaxies." Very well. But one little question, one all-important question, is left unanswered. Where did all this material come from that created that initial first Big Bang? And often the lame response of the materialist is, oh, that matter was always there. It was always there, and then something happened to change things that created the Big Bang, but the matter was always there. Doesn't it seem strange to you that we can accept unquestioningly the eternity of matter, but we cannot accept the eternity of God? It's okay to say, yes, the matter was always there before the Big Bang, but we can't accept that God has always been. Secondly, we need to ask if man, by dismissing God, can adequately explain the order and the design which we find in the universe. For men and women are really closed into one of two choices, and at the end of the day, there really are only two choices. They either choose to believe that they are the product of a vast cosmic accident, or they believe they are the product of design. It's one or the other. I want you to imagine an explosion in Collins Printworks, an accidental explosion. And as the pieces are thrown into the air, they somehow or other randomly bash against each other, and as the explosion settles, floating down out of the sky, you see over 30 volumes of an encyclopedia, printed, collated, edited, bound, floating down to the ground. Ah, you say, wait a minute, you are stretching the bounds of human credibility. How could such a thing accidentally, randomly happen? Well, I tell you this, that the creation of the universe by accident is on the scale of that explosion in Collins Printworks. Tony Holland, who is professor of chemical engineering at the University of Salford, was a scientific humanist up until the age of 30. Then he was challenged by the question, is there a God? And this is what he concluded. On consideration, it was inconceivable to me that the complex system of which we are a part could have occurred without a creator. Just as a great symphony testifies to the skill of a composer, the world and the universe testify to the wisdom and the power of God. Science is but a description of God's work. Now, the case for the origin of the universe is often mischievously presented as accepting either on the one hand the findings of reason and science, or on the other what the Bible has to say in faith and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. You're either a Big Banger who has evolved from an accident in time or space, or you accept that God created. In the beginning, God created. Now, I think it's important for us to recognize that the opening chapters of Genesis do not claim to be a scientific account of the mechanics of God's creation. Whether God used a Big Bang or not is irrelevant at this point. What the opening chapters of Genesis are determined to declare is the fact of God's creation. God created. God is a creator God. That's the thrust of these opening chapters of Genesis. But there are those who are saying, you either accept the findings of science and of reason and all the power of human intellect, or you bury your intellectual head in the sand and you read the Bible and you accept what it says by faith. Those are the mischievous alternatives that are placed often before us. But you see, both views require faith. Whether you're putting your confidence in what God says about himself in Scripture, or whether you're putting your confidence in the fact that nothing existed in terms of a creator, and that the world has come from a big bang, an accident, nothing more than that, also requires faith. A contemporary writer commenting on the view that we are merely creatures of chance has said this: at some remote point in history, nothing became something. By chance, the ingredients occurred from a spontaneous creation. Of course, this view presupposes the existence of the basic ingredients of matter, which seem to leave us where we were. In other words, where did that matter come from? Frankly, I think that it takes more faith to be an atheist than to believe in God. You see, the atheist is a man of faith. The atheist is a man of faith. Would you be surprised to learn that the man in the street has greater confidence in scientific theory than many scientists themselves have? Let me quote from a contemporary British scientist. Many people, wishing to bolster an argument, will declare, "The scientist says." Such an approach is based on two fallacies. The first is to believe that the scientist lacks any prejudice. But nothing in history supports this view. Take the field of medicine. Lord Lister introduced antiseptics to surgery. You might have thought that he would have been hailed as a great innovator by the profession, and that honors would have been heaped upon him. The reverse was true. He was vilified, mocked, and scorned. His views would never have gained ground were it not for the fact that his patients lived and those of his detractors died. The second fallacy arises from a failure to recognize that by its nature, science is always changing. No scientist can arrive at certainty. It used to be taught in school that matter could neither be created nor destroyed. However, Einstein reasoned that if you could destroy mass, the energy released would be equivalent to the product of that mass destroyed and the speed of light squared. Well, we all knew that, didn't we? People did not laugh at Einstein. Eventually, over the Nevada desert arose that sinister mushroom cloud, and it was demonstrated that man had learned to split the atom, and the mass of the residue was less than the original. In other words, what science had previously said could not be done, mass or matter could not be destroyed, was in fact destroyed. So scientists themselves recognize that their science is not an absolute thing, that what they say is the case. Certain years hence can clearly be disproved. So that we need to guard against investing upon the findings of modern science a quality of infallibility. Now, the skepticism of our age has deepened as man has increasingly placed more and more faith in himself, in his reason, in his scientific ability, in his developed mind. And man, modern man, often says, if I cannot understand God to my satisfaction, I will not believe in his existence. But that approach is also flawed. It is flawed because on a daily basis we exercise faith in things we do not understand. I don't fully understand the digestive system. It doesn't stop me from eating. And I don't wholly understand the respiratory system, but it doesn't stop me from breathing. I continue to breathe. The approach which says I will not believe in God until I can understand him is further flawed in that it attempts to bring God down to our tiny little finite level. To say I will only believe in a God that I can fully understand and analyze is just another way of saying I will not believe in a God who is greater than I am. In one of his plays, George Bernard Shaw described one of his characters as a self-made man who worships his creator. Think about it. A self-made man who worships his creator. When we close our mind to what God discloses about himself, and so close God out, then, and this is Paul's argument in Romans 1, we worship the creature rather than the creator. Is there then another approach to answering the question, is anyone there? Well, the Bible reminds us that without faith it is impossible to please God, and that anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists, and again that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Now that doesn't mean, as many people have assumed that it means, that we have to kiss goodbye to our brains. This faith is not a leap in the dark, nor does it involve us sitting in the dark whistling, hoping God is there. It's not an attempt to sort of bolster some security. Rather, it is a faith in a God who has made himself known. And in that sense, it is a reasonable faith. Paul makes it clear in Romans chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. What may be known about God, he says, is plain to them, because God has made it plain. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Do you see what Paul is saying? When you look at the created universe, you argue from that to God's existence because you see his power and his wisdom in the created order. The psalmist reminds us that the heavens declare his righteousness. In other words, the order and the design of the universe argue the existence of a wise designer. Our Earth, I'm told, is 93 million miles or so from the sun. Any nearer the sun and this planet would be scorched. Any further away from the sun and this planet would freeze. A wise and a powerful designer. But we read also in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11 that God has placed eternity in the heart of man. In other words, there is a holy dissatisfaction in man's heart, telling him that there is more to life than this treadmill existence down here, persuading him that the grave is not the end. But our internal knowledge is more than this sense of destiny. We read in Genesis that God made man in his image. And among other things, that involves creating man a moral being. Wherever you go in the world, you will find evidence of the fact that God's law has been written in man's heart, so that men do instinctively know the difference between right and wrong. Whether you stay in Bergedi or Bachtaran, no one needs to tell you murder is wrong, stealing is wrong, lying is wrong, and so on. Now, that knowledge, of course, can be suppressed. We can suppress God's truth in our consciences when our consciences say this particular code of action is wrong. And in Romans chapter 1 and verse 18, we read of men who suppress the truth about God by their wickedness. If you like, knowledge of what God is floats like a log in the human consciousness, buoyant. Little children have no difficulty, you see, in accepting the idea of God's character or existence. It's adults that complicate things. But that knowledge can be held under the surface long enough for the log to become waterlogged, and it sinks, and the knowledge is not as useful to us as it once was. We have suppressed it. But of course, we don't escape our knowledge of God so easily. For God reveals himself, not just internally, his law written in our hearts. He reveals himself in this book with unmistakable clarity and power. Despite our best efforts to suppress our knowledge of him, I heard only last week of a Serbian soldier who had entered a Croat village to engage in some ethnic cleansing. And in one home, he found some Christian literature, which he took home and read. And as a result, he came to faith in Christ. He had managed to suppress God's law written in his heart that told him murder was wrong. And he was out there in a crusade to ethnically cleanse a particular village. And despite his best efforts to call wrong right, God spoke through his word to that man's heart and radically changed the whole direction of his life. He discovered the God who is there. There is one final piece of information we need, which causes us to face our origin. In making man like himself, God did not only make him a moral being, but made him personal and spiritual as well. For man has been made for fellowship with God. And when he's not experiencing fellowship with God, he experiences an inner restlessness which nothing else can fill. Augustine put it this way, "My heart is restless until it finds its rest in you." And Pascal describes man as having a God-shaped blank in his life. And until that spiritual vacuum is filled, he knows an emptiness nothing can fill. No other adequate explanation has ever been given for the spiritual dimension in man's life. This is what separates man from the rest of the created order. Have you ever seen a field of sheep praying? Have you ever seen a herd of horses queuing up to get into church? No. Because man is distinctive from the rest of the created order. He has a spiritual awareness, a spirituality which God has invested in him and only in mankind. For we have been made for God's company, for fellowship with him, so that we either possess a God-shaped blank in our lives, or we are possessed by God, and we have begun to realize the purpose of our existence. You may be thinking this morning, but I've got no problem with accepting the fact that God exists. For the reasons you've mentioned, and many more, I am happy with the idea of God's existence. But we need to press our thinking further. For often when people say they believe in God, what they really mean is, I believe in my kind of God. I believe in a God who suits me. I believe in a God who is a kind of benevolent heavenly grandfather there to cater for my every whim and to grant my every wish. In other words, a God built to my specifications, a God made in my image. In answer to the question, is anyone there? God replies, yes, I am. I am the one who has created you for myself. I am the one who alone can equip you to live life to the full. I am a God worth searching for, a God worth knowing. And when you find me, you will discover that I began to look for you before you began to look for me. I am not found accidentally, says God, if you seek me with your whole heart. You will surely find me. The God who has created the universe around us, the God who has made us in his image for fellowship with himself, and the God who has plans for a life, a God who has a destiny and purposes of blessing. That God is there, and that is the God that can be known, and that is the God who made himself known in coming down into our world to claim what no one else ever claimed. Man in the flesh, yet holy God, to die for us, to pour out his life for us, that we might enjoy again fellowship with himself.